Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Sea Control, East Atlantic Sea Control panel podcast. Tonight we are not joined by Chris Stockdale-Garbutt, the president of UK SimSec, because he's got glandular fever, so our thoughts are with him. And also, he should remember that is called the kissing disease, so perhaps he should be more careful. I'm Alex Clark.
Well, this age.
I'm Alex Clark of the Phoenix Think Tank. That other voice you just heard is one of our first-time guest, Douglas Clark. Yes, he is my father. He's also an excellent naval architect, and trust me,
what
there
do you
is
mean
no excellent. I said excellent, not X. I'm regretting this decision already. And we're joined by our regular Commander Paul Fisher, RN retired, who is the stalwart of this panel, and frankly, I have done the timing, and between him and me, we do account for something like 80% of the speaking. Okay. However, I have a feeling this evening with my father here, we might not get as many words in. Right then. Tonight's topic is, he says, opening it up. Ah, there it is. Right. Grand vision or ruthless pragmatism, which is the better guide for construction and design and constitution of a fleet in the 21st century? And before Matthew and Chris do correct me on this, I did add in the construction. I know it just had constitution in the original draft, but it makes more sense with the construction. Right. I'll allow you two to introduce yourselves a bit. We'll start off with the new boy. Dad, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, well, I spent a long time playing around with warships, and for a lot of time I've not thought the Navy's decisions were always as pragmatic as they ought to be. I think they are often led by people's prejudices rather than what we really need to do. Mm. And I think sometimes what we need to do is not always what is apparently obvious straight away. Mm. And I think some of our, the decision not to put our ships with guns, you know, was disastrous. Because what does a warship do but goes and needs to fight? If it hasn't got a gun, what does it fight with? It can't fight with missiles. You can't fight every battle with missiles. And there we were. We constructed a whole series of ships with no guns on them, which I felt at the time and said so, and was told I was an idiot. I didn't understand modern warfare. I don't think warfare changes. It's just the way we handle it and the array of weapons we have to throw at it. But we still need, I know we don't use swords anymore, but nevertheless, we still use bayonets. And the infantryman wouldn't like to go on the field without his bayonet. And quite honestly, it seemed to me that at the time, sending a warship out without a gun on it, that it could be fired, a local issue, was the same as sending an infantryman without his,
bayonet.
Spike.
Yeah.
Bayonet.
Right. To our regular,
what you think.
Paul, to introduce yourself.
Yeah, very briefly, I've contributed to the Phoenix Think Tank. I'm very much retired, although I have to say my the job list I get at home doesn't make me feel that sometimes.
And your brain
still
certainly isn't retired.
And my brain hasn't retired yet, thank goodness. I'm very, very interested in looking at the future and where navies are going, and in particular where the UK, the Royal Navy, is going. I served for nearly 30 years in the Royal Navy, but I find as time goes on and the more distant that experience becomes, that I'm becoming more and more radical in the way that I think that we possibly have taken a slightly a cul-de-sac in our development. And I'd just like to, as we're about to launch into the discussion, I'd just like to take up Doug with something he said, and from a designer's point of view, and I approach things from a sort of now, from a sort of the concept of it all. And I have to say that what you've just said, Doug, is basically the thrust of where I now look at things. I think one of the mistakes of the last, of certainly the towards the end of the Cold War and then post the Cold War, is that we, in the certainly the UK Navy, have lost a little bit of direction, in the sense that we have forgotten some of the basics. And the basics are that a warship needs to be able to go to sea and fight. And that isn't completely driven by what we think today's threat is. You need to be able to go out there and fire things at the opposition or the potential opposition. Today, of course, we've got a much bigger array of weapons, but I still think we need the full spectrum of weapons, which starts with what today are quite sophisticated weapons, guns with some pretty sophisticated munitions, through the various types of missiles. The modern term is fires, typically American sort of expression, but I in principle and concept agree with Doug. So here we have the first agreement of the evening, that we should be focusing on a slightly more offensive view of navies rather than a defensive view that seemed to come to fruition as we went through the Cold War.
It was all started because we thought nuclear submarines would solve it all.
Yes, yeah.
I remember Raymond Hawkins, a blessed memory, once said quite honestly that the submarine was an offensive weapon. You still needed things that would do other things as well.
Yeah.
But we seem to have lost that general purpose in Navy. I mean, we've got these massive aircraft carriers with no bloody aircraft on them. I mean, what more stupid way can you go design a navy? Well, I mean, what the hell's a good two bloody great big aircraft carriers if you've got nothing to fly off them? Mm. You know, where are we going? And whose idea is to spend all this money on these virtually obsolete bits of kit, metal?
Well, that's the trouble. They're not obsolete. They're obsolete because of our own decisions. And I always remember, I cheered. I was very happy when the coalition government made a decision to make the carriers Qatar. I was going, yes, this will be good. This means if the Joint Strike Fighter does fail, bless its cotton socks, we can go for the F-18, which is actually a fairly good aircraft. I know some people kept going on about the Rafael, but and I know it's a lovely aircraft, but if I was going to pick, I'd go for the F-18 every time, because it comes with an electronic warfare version. And if stealth doesn't work, it's electronic warfare you have to rely on to get yourself through the enemy defences. And I like to point out to us, well, that the US Navy, the Navy which should be the most bought into the F-35, is a Navy which is pushing the hardest on its own electronic warfare aircraft. And it's making big play with the rest of the US Air Force, going, you can't operate without us because you need our electronic warfare aircraft, which is capability you no longer have.
Yeah, but is this not the trouble with all military personnel? That they pick some way of they see forward. And it used to annoy me that someone would come on a warship, you know, he'd have his 3 years to do in a shipyard, and he'd come on and start changing what his predecessor did, just so he could put his mark on it, which didn't really improve the operational capability of the warship.
Mm.
It gave him something to put his name to, but is that what we want?
Well, I think, Doug, I've witnessed this many times, and I think we're sort of that we're moving into the title a bit as well. If one had a sound, I use conceptual base, a sound underpinning reason for doing things, then the individual comings and goings of people in various jobs and appointments would at least be directed, you know.
Or controlled.
Or controlled, exactly. And this is the sort of almost the contrast between the sort of immediacy of what the title says is ruthless pragmatism, set against a direction, a view as to how we should be shaping our fighting capability, not from individual preference, but from a corporate or from a collective view of which way we're headed to, if I could put it that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's what we want to do, what we have
exactly.
To do.
Yes.
I mean, this is it. And it seems to me that we get lost in these blokes with grandiose ideas, because I've got 10 rings around my wrist.
Yes.
You know, I'm entitled to make this decision.
Yes.
And the fact that it leaves the rest of us exposed, just because, I mean, I was astonished. I saw some decisions were made over the 39-45 war. I mean, someone said, oh, the Germans will never come through the Ardennes. They bloody well did.
Well, quite.
And why? Well, why did we say to ourselves they won't? Why wasn't someone watching?
To be fair, the French said they couldn't get their tanks through the Ardennes, so no one else could. The thing was, the Germans built tanks which were slightly smaller and slightly narrower than the French, so they could go through trees.
Yeah, but I mean, we surely knew that was going on.
Oh, look, just because it's happening in front of you doesn't mean you take any notice of it.
Well, this is why, this is the thrust of our point.
Yes, exactly.
If it's happening in front of you, then for God's sake be able to deal with it. Because if you can't deal with it, you're dead.
I think one of the most interesting things I've seen, and I've been recently dealing with, is the rise of private security escort ships. And the reason I say this is because they have come to the fore because of the problems with piracy. And people keep saying they're because of the lack of escorts, which is true. But also, if you think about it, if we'd had enough of those cheap, cheerful presence ships, i.e. like the Leander class used to be, that would wander around the world, would piracy have happened, gone to the level it did in the first place? Or would there have been a couple of frigates in the area to go, hello, go home?
I've got a pop. I can see you out of the water.
You don't
Bye-bye.
Really need much to take on a pirate. And this is the thing.
You need a pop. If you haven't got a pop,
you're fine with a pop. But the thing again with the ruthless pragmatism, I keep listening to people talking about the Type 26, and they keep saying it's slightly less is less capable than the Type 45, and I'm going, well, why are we building two ships then? Why are we going through all that money to research and develop another type of ship, and not just building a Type 45 and going, right, these will have the expensive air defence radar, and these won't. But they'll be fitted for it, so if in later date we need more ships with that air defence radar, all we have to do is buy the radar and stick it on them.
That's not true. It's not that easy.
Well, if you build it with the cables capable of taking that radar...
Yeah, but they won't be the right cables in the end, because over development time they'll change. And this, I mean, electronics changes so bloody fast these days, what you fit in today won't be any use tomorrow.
Yes. That's quite true.
Come on. This is not pragmatic. This is wasting money.
Well, no. My theory then was we just build the same hull and just keep building the same ship. Because the Americans have found that's the true reason why the Arleigh Burke is coming in so much cheaper than any of the other options. Because all they're doing is building the same ship.
You've got a hull, and you can put what you want into it, providing you fit it out with what you want. But you've got to fit it out with what you want when you're building it, not come back later. It was to cost a small fortune, and you virtually ruin the ship, because it's no longer a cohesive. You are virtually taking it apart to put it together again. It's just daft.
Yeah, I think if I were to... We're getting down into sort of implementation. I mean, we have this... I mean, I personally feel that the Type 45 is... should we say, slightly expensive, but actually there's a lack of clarity about these ships. Instead of limiting ourselves and saying that this ship is a sort of an air defense ship, a surface-to-air missile-carrying ship, what we should be saying is, yes, it's that, I don't have a problem with that, and I know there are plans in place. I think we also, it's basically... a missile ship. It has a gun as well. So what we should have is, there are only three places that missiles are targeted against. One is other ships. Two is aircraft or airborne vehicles, whichever way you like to look at it, and thirdly, the land. And so the Type 45 should not just be seen as a surface-to-air missile ship. It should be seen as a missile-firing ship that can fire against air targets, can launch things like Tomahawk against land targets, and fire some sort of missile, the best we've got or whatever, against other ships. Now, if you do that, then actually, that is the only missile-firing ship you need at sea. There are submarines that fire missiles as well, and we know that they, you know, that they're there. That's fine. Don't have a problem with that.
But they still have torpedoes.
Exactly. And then there's the submarine problem that you need to... the only thing that can kill a submarine is a torpedo.
Yeah.
And so you need means of firing or launching torpedoes. Now, you can launch torpedoes from airborne vehicles. You can launch them from ships. And, of course, you can launch them from other submarines. And I think we need to look at it that way rather than... So that's, you know, the Type 45 hull, I don't have a problem with that. It's quite capable of firing three types of missiles, suitably yes. adapted. Go for it. And it can have its gun and all that sort of thing. I think you do need another class of ships, and that is the ship, because the other sort of projectile that you can fire is the gun or the shell. And I think you could have... I mean, literally, gunships. I mean, we used to call them send a gunboat.
Yeah. Gunboat diplomacy.
We used to say that. Now, that was within a different age, technology and all that sort of thing. But actually, there is a role for a patrol ship with guns. It doesn't have to carry any missiles. It can just have guns on it. It could be used for these lower-level roles, if you like to look at it that way.
But do you really want a heavily costly missile ship?
No.
Wandering around with silos of very expensive...
No. You want a cheap and... I don't like using the expression, but because they're not necessarily cheap, but they need to be cheap and cheerful, so-called, gun ships, which have... You can have quite sophisticated guns on them.
Well, this is my whole point with us building these new river classes. And A, we need to have all seven. They can't replace four with three again. We can't keep going down with patrol boats because there's all sorts of missions they do where, frankly, you don't want to have more than a patrol boat. And having seven patrol boats was actually useful. But the point always looking at them is, why don't we give them a close-in weapon system and why don't they have a medium gun on them? In which case, the close-in weapon system would give them a sort of level of air defence, but would also defend them if, let's say, they got into trouble and did get a missile coming in. I mean, they weren't defenceless.
And a gun.
That's all they need on them, basically.
Yeah.
And well, if I mean, you add in other stuff, you know, the thing I look at is I look at the Danish, because I think they're probably the best ones at the moment. And they have the Standflex system. Which is where they can adapt the ship. So they have another Musen class, which are patrol boats, which literally go round as gunboats all the time. But if they do get into war where they have trouble, they just take out the Standflex modules and stick in missile Standflex modules so they have missiles. And they're doing this, they've scaled this up. It's on their frigates, their new frigates they're building. It's on the Absalom class, their multi-role equivalent of the LCS, which can transport a couple of hundred troops plus tanks. And all this, as well as being a fully functioning frigate, or virtually a destroyer. Uh-huh. And you're sort of sitting there going, well, how come the Danish Navy has got this, and managed to invest this, and got it working, and everyone else is not?
Mm. Well, it's because the people that are running the thing, surely, are not really... they're not tuned in to what they ought to be doing.
Yeah,
I mean, I think the disaster. I mean, I think once we lost the likes of Nelson, of course, who was a pragmatic admiral. I think since then we've had blokes who pretend they understand warfare but don't really understand warfare. Mm. You listen to the generals and all that. You've got another chap now saying we need troops to go into Syria, but if you put troops in Syria, you've got to bloody well support them. Mm. And how the bloody hell can we support them? We can't even get at them in there now and out. How can we support troops if we put them in there? Mm. I mean, it's no good putting troops in if you can't support them.
Well, I think that's another aspect at sea, certainly, that I have to say, from the sort of long-term operational things that I've seen going on at sea, something that is it's not forgotten, but it's not given the right priority, is the logistics of
operation,
keeping things going. It's what an old captain of mine used to call poise, or being ready to fight. And if you're not out there 365 days a year, or are unable to stay there for long periods of time, a lot of your value disappears, and you need that support structure to keep you going. And an army is the same. On the land, it needs logistics. I mean, the reason the German army was so successful in the Second World War, and it's not talked about very much, is because they had a superb logistics system supporting their army.
Yeah.
Absolutely
superb.
Superb. And that is the power, was the power behind the German army.
Yeah. I also would like to point out they did still also have a large part of their logistics system was actually horse-drawn carriages, but seeing as that was their infantry divisions, it didn't really matter.
No!
Whereas if you look at the British Army, it was the only fully mechanised force in the beginning of the Second World War. And, of course, it had the fun, and ended up having to withdraw from Dunkirk and leave quite a lot of its equipment behind. Mostly because, well, it didn't really think about what was happening on its flanks enough. It couldn't. It wasn't big enough. But
you know, no, its leaders weren't big enough to think through what their problems were.
Mm.
They pretended to dismiss things too easy. Oh, that will never happen.
Mm.
It's too easy for these big blokes who, once they get five rings around their wrists, think they, you know, their decisions are final. They're not. They're the last, you know, someone's looking out to bloody well trip them up all the time.
The enemy always has a say in every decision. Yes.
And I think one of our big problems with our military is, and looking at your research, and I've been with you, is the fact that pragmatism is not the first and foremost thought in a lot of our leaders' ideas.
No.
We are going, what could happen? What happens if? Mm. I mean, it's the old business of I was saying to your sister, Ali, you know, failure mode effect analysis is inbuilt into every engineer because it's the way he has to think. If this bit of metal doesn't take the load, what happens? The whole bloody ship falls apart. Yeah. That's not a caliber way of building it.
Whereas if our modern forces, the way they're constructed, there is no slack in them if anything fails.
No.
And this is the trouble. This is the whole. This is the whole problem. Another big reason this is going to get me into trouble, because I already get into trouble with BAE over the Type 26. I once said, "Well, why don't the Royal Navy? Why couldn't the Royal Navy get 18?" They said they're ordering 13. This was a Twitter argument. I was going, "Why are you even correcting me? Why are you even fighting me back?" If the British government decided they wanted 18 Type 26s, are you going to turn around and say, no, we won't sell you 18? But leaving that to one side, this whole thing, we're building a frigate, which up till recently was called the Global Combat Ship, then got called the frigate, and still, the most thing people keep coming with is it's for anti-submarine warfare.
What the hell?
No, it isn't. It's like having the Type 45 as an area defense destroyer. We should have just built a general-purpose big warship and a general-purpose small warship. The big one would have missiles and a big gun on it, and the small one would have lots of guns on it with a medium gun.
Mm.
Both would be able to support amphibious warfare, both would be able to bombard land targets and deal with pirates, but the big warships would be built in enough numbers to provide the task groups for wartime, and the small ones would be built in enough numbers to do the patrol job and do all the maritime security stuff.
And add the odd missile to knock out something that was coming through the sky at them.
Well, I would borrow the Standflex system for the Danish, and then if they look like they're going in a scenario which they require a missile for, stick it on them. If not, don't worry, it saves some maintenance.
I think the other thing is that there needs to be a bit of realism about what I call horses for courses.
Yeah.
The best weapon to hunt a submarine is with another submarine. Now, I happen to be a surface Navy guy, so, I mean, I'm saying that. There is no doubt in my mind that if you want to go out and do what's known as anti-submarine warfare, the way to do it is with another submarine. There is no doubt about that. And I don't think we've thought that one through sufficiently, especially during the Cold War days when we designed our Navy, which is when there was a big turning point into what was known as anti-submarine warfare sort of based Navy. I mean, where we ended up with the ludicrous situation of Batch 1 Type 22s, which we used to joke when I was serving as the most highly protected sonar set afloat. Well, no, because it was. Because it had no gun, it had Seawolf to protect it against missiles, it had a couple of Exocet, which were relatively short range, 20 nautical mile surface-to-surface missiles, and what was its utility? It couldn't go and fight anybody. All it could do was sit there and radiate its sonar. And actually, a surface ship sonar is one of the most inefficient ways, a hull-mounted sonar, of trying to find a submarine. The way to do
it's the submarine's only going to be out of range, and you can't find it.
You're finished.
Yeah.
It's like a dot on a map.
Yeah.
And so there wasn't
How does another submarine, if the sonar can't, the ship can't find it, how does another submarine find another submarine?
Oh, well, they use their, I mean, because a submarine platform is the best, the quietest platform upon which to put very, very good sonars.
Oh, I see.
Sonars. And so it's absolutely perfect for doing that. And, of course, what I find...
Providing the submarine comes within the range of your listening capability.
And here we have a problem again, because you've got the fact is that nuclear submarines, whilst they're very good, can never be silent, because they always have to correct the reactor on low power, which is why SSKs in defence always have the advantage on DAIPs. And this is something which I find it very funny. The Americans and the Royal Navy and various other navies in the world keep going on about how brilliant nuclear submarines are, but also how good SSKs are. They keep toying with the idea of building their own, but not, because they go, oh, we've got the SSNs. Now, we used to have SSKs in the UK. We got rid of them. We went for an all-SSN fleet. But the point is, if you look at the big numbers where submarines are growing, it's in diesel submarines. Now, Japan could afford to invest in a nuclear submarine if they wanted. But they're not. They're still going with SSKs.
But I think the
And Australia could afford if they really wanted any SSNs, but they're going with SSKs. Because they work and they're cheaper, and you can buy about four of them for the cost of one and a third Astutes.
Well, it's the parallel argument between what I would call the Type 45 sophisticated missile firer and the patrol ship, as I like to call it, and the SSN and the, well, they used to be called patrol submarines, the conventional ones. So, I mean, I come back to this issue that we haven't thought through conceptually what we're trying to achieve here. And once you've got that framework in place, which I don't think does exist with clarity, you can then be, as your title says, very pragmatic. You build to meet what you want to achieve. And that, I think, brings the two sides together, if I could put it like that, is that we don't have a template which we're driving towards in terms of what we're trying to achieve overall, and therefore you're always going to get sort of odd, conflicting decisions about what you build or don't build, or somebody's personal idea or hobby horse or whatever.
Well,
it is.
Well, this is the trouble. It's driven that way, isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly. I agree. Totally agree with that.
I mean, no one sits down and
thinks it out.
Thinks out the scenarios that could
exactly.
exist.
Exactly.
And until someone actually defines those scenarios,
yes,
we don't even have a hope in hell.
And I think the worst thing is, it's to be honest, it's not even the navies which are the worst examples of this. If you consider some of the vehicles the army's procured for counterinsurgency warfare, COIN, aren't they going? What practical use are some of those vehicles going to be in a real war? I not. That Afghanistan isn't a real war, but a war where you're fighting a peer-to-peer adversary with tanks. You've got these huge high vehicles which are designed to resist IEDs and mines. Great. But they're huge, tall vehicles. Nice big targets for taking on a tank or a tank missile. This is the trouble. They've been procured, and they're very useful for that mission. But the army now no longer has enough vehicles to have vehicle fleets for separate missions. And whilst they needed to be procured, when they were being procured, if someone had sat there and gone, look, we're going to be saddled with these vehicles for the next 25, 30 years, at the least, let's put a little long-term thinking into them, they might not be in the predicament they look like they're in now. And you even look at the new Scout vehicle. One of the tenets that there has always been is you shouldn't fight for information, because that tells the enemy what you have. And they've slapped it's a huge little light tank. It's replacing the CVRTs, but it is a far bigger vehicle with a far bigger gun. Anyone can see it's a light tank. And yes, if that's what you want, but that's okay for information denial operations, counter reconnaissance. I can't see that being useful for reconnaissance, because again, it's a big vehicle with a gun on it, and it's going, if they've got a gun on it, soldiers are going to be tempted to start fighting with it, aren't they? If you're in a war zone, you have a gun, you're going to be tempted to start fighting.
You're going to try to shoot, aren't you?
I always remember Monty, I think, wrote once, he was attempted, when Long Range Desert Patrol was conceived, Montgomery was asked his opinion on it, because he was still back in the UK at the time, and I can't remember exactly, I'm not so good with generals as I am with admirals, that they should go to battle with their guns all locked in the boot of the vehicle, so they could only get them out if there was a real emergency and a real need for it. Otherwise, they wouldn't be tempted to shoot. That is the sort of thing, you know, when you've got those things. And then you've got the aircraft. We've got 8 now Tornadoes taking part in bombing Iraq and ISIS in Iraq. Has anyone noticed a lack of a rather large aircraft which keeps appearing in air displays? I think it's called the Typhoon. We spent a lot of money procuring it, yet it appears every time there's a bombing mission, or something which we actually use aircraft for, i.e. long-range artillery, it either needs the Tornado to go along and target the target for it, so it can hit it, or it actually doesn't go and we send Tornadoes instead. And this seems strange to me. It also seems strange to me because we've saved the Tornado and sacrificed the Harrier and the Carriers, when really, possibly, the Harrier and Carrier might have made more sense. But again, where's the pragmatism hasn't been applied to this?
Yeah, but someone had a death wish, didn't they, for the Harrier?
Yes.
Because it was old. You know, it's passé technology. It isn't. It's very useful technology.
Oh, yes, I agree with that.
I mean, you know, the bloody thing's on your platform.
Quite.
You can build a new platform to take whatever the developed or developing gun or missile or whatever you want is, and it will probably carry it, because let's face it, the engines can be improved. Rolls have proved that. I mean, the latest jet engines are terribly powerful for the size they are. I mean, if this was their problem, then the power's there.
And the other thing with that, you have to consider, the stupid thing was for the Harrier. They stopped the Sea Harrier developed with the air defence missile capability on that radar, and they carried on with the ground attack variant. Now, if they'd actually taken over the ground attack systems and added them onto the Sea Harrier, and instead had Sea Harrier Mark III, or just called it Combined Harrier, which could do the air defence as well as the ground attack missions...
Yeah.
How could you call that aircraft unuseful and out of date? Because that's a single multi-role aircraft, which would have also been the best one of the best beyond visual range radars that were in service at the time.
Plus the fact you don't need a massive airfield for Harriers.
No.
You can you can place them somewhere safe and get them off the ground and fuel them. Put them back in the air. Whereas at the moment you're flying from West Cyprus.
Yes.
And
well, are we not saying in all this that, I mean, the platforms, you know, they can develop. But I come back to this point about, you know, what are you firing? And it's the sophistication or utility of the weapon system which is really important. I'll give you an example of this. When me and I happen to have sort of lived and breathed C-Dart and Type 42s, yeah. But that's now lots of problems with it, you know, old system, blah blah blah. But actually, there was one stage a project called the C-Dart Midlife Update Program, and this was in fact cancelled, as lots of programs are, in my view, a very short-term view. And again, it comes back to this pragmatism. And the reason that I think it wasn't just a flawed decision in terms of that weapon system, it was a flawed decision in terms of the UK being able to have the expertise and wherewithal to continue the sort of the industry, if you like, of producing that sort of sophisticated weapon system.
Yeah.
Now, just to give you some very bold figures, the C-Dart system, which, you know, existed, the basic system, you know, this had a putative surface-to-air range of 40 miles, which is not bad. No. It could get up to an altitude of just over 60,000 feet in its firing envelope. It was the radar, the fire control radar associated with 909, had a target acquisition range of 100 nautical miles. Exactly. But the midlife update program was going to update the missile so that it had an extended range to actually go out to the sort of nearer, instead of 40 miles, nearer 80 miles, so that you could exploit a radar which would not have had to have been altered at all. So the rocket technology and the control technology for the missile itself, just think what that would have done. And of course, what happened? The American equivalent was Standard 2, which was equivalent to C-Dart when we were working with it. Yeah. They went for Standard 3 and did exactly that. And that was what was fitted originally in the Aegis class cruisers, air defense cruisers. We could have done that, but a short-term decision was made. We're going to cut this program, but it would have meant more than that. Now, in the Type 45, we are entirely dependent upon a missile system built on the continent. We have destroyed our own missile industry. In fact, can you name a maritime missile system that is built in the UK?
There isn't one.
There isn't one. And, you know, we at one stage, if we had developed Sea Eagle as a surface-to-surface launched missile, if we'd stuck with it, it used to be an air-to-surface missile, we would have had an equivalent of Harpoon.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is that we're focusing on the wrong area here. The platforms, frankly, you can. I know this is heresy.
You can build them
anywhere. You can build them anywhere. You can put them on merchant ships.
Yeah.
Frankly, if you're really desperate. And let's face it, escort carriers in the Second World War were converted merchant ships.
Yeah.
And what we should be focusing on from a military point of view is the military bit, which is the killing bit. Sorry, I'm very strong about this, so you have
to I agree with you.
Getting passionate. You know, we need to go for high-end stuff.
I can build any platform you want.
Yeah.
But an electronics man has got to produce the thing that makes it effective.
Exactly. And the thing that makes it effective are the weapon systems and the sensors. And actually, that's where our investment should have gone. And we should have gone for cheap and cheerful hulls, in my view.
See, the civil service, God bless them, had an idea that our financial system would overtake everyone else's, and we could buy what we wanted.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had this sort of almost straight view vision. There was no thought as to what they were doing to industry. I mean, they don't seem to realise you've got to keep people employed.
Well, exactly.
I think they're still I don't think a lot of the civil service realise that if you kill industry off, you kill your employment systems off.
Well, quite.
I mean, this is what they did, willy-nilly, because we were going to have bankers. What were all these people going to do when they had no work to do? Well, were the bankers going to be able to fund their enjoyment?
No.
No.
But I do, and I think that's where, in the UK, we've lost our technical manufacturing lead, well, capability, let alone any lead.
I think it's still there.
It's still there, but it needs reinvestment.
Nurturing. It needs bringing back into
focus. I would point out that, yes, just before we get too far, the actual fact, the MBDA and FAILS, a lot of their research and development is actually done in the UK. It's the actual manufacturing of the missiles which aren't done here, which I think is a big problem, because they develop it all here, and then it has to go and be manufactured elsewhere, which can't be secure. You know, you'd want it. And also, it doesn't seem to be good to have the scientists in one country developing it and the factories in another. And seeing as we're the ones buying it as well, surely we can say where we build it. But leaving that all to one side, the fact is, the BA, the model that the River Glass has been built on, have produced a very successful hull. That is perfect for those missions, the gunboat missions, perfect for those, that sort of role, and perfect to have anything added onto later if you really want to. It's got the space in it. But the thing is, our own government are making minimal use of that hull. In fact, it's at the moment, currently, I think there are more foreign versions of that hull than there are British ones. Mm. Now, admittedly, that's good from an export point of view, so yay. But if the rest of the world is buying the version at hull with better guns, and we still buy it and consider the 30mm pop-pop the best thing since sliced bread for our patrol ships, I think we're going somewhere wrong. I think we're forgetting the purpose of these ships. I think we're also forgetting the purpose of the sensors and the weapons.
This is the pragmatic bit that you were talking about originally. Mm. We have no pragmatism.
No.
There's no one. It seems as though our Ministry of Defence has got a lot of guys running around all day with files of paper under their arm. We're paying them a lot of money, and they're not actually delivering.
No. Well, I think this is the other thing. If you look across Europe, just European nations that build warships, I think you'll find the UK comes near the bottom of the list of the countries that have actually exported any ships.
It does once you get past the Leander class.
I'm saying today. Today.
That's the thing. Leander class was brilliant.
We
built about 60 of them for the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Had about 30 ourselves. Mm. We did a great thing, and then we managed to various words which can't be said on podcasts it up, and we didn't follow it. We didn't follow onward. We then decided
to
build an exclusive.
We never do, because someone in finance decides he's not going to make enough money, and if he sells his shares in this or he sells this company to someone else, he'll get a mint, and that's all. He'll be able to go and sit on his estate, shoot his pheasants, fly fish his fish, and he can go away. And he's got enough money in his pocket. The fact that he's caused unemployment for 30 or 40,000 people is neither here nor there.
No, and this is where we do need a bigger vision of where we're going. That's where I would say, because it needs to cut across this self-interest to a certain extent. It needs to...
There's too much self-interest.
Exactly. It needs to establish a route forward which rolls over the self-interest to a more long-term view, if you like.
Yeah, but we never have in this country.
No.
I mean, let's face it, the number of ideas that have been developed and people have run away with for nothing, virtually, particularly the Americans, have made millions out of it and then charged us for bloody... I mean, Sidney Jones developed the tilting train.
Yeah.
Who do we buy it from? The Italians.
Mm. And the Japanese.
Well, no, the Italians, the one that's on the West Coast main line. But the point is, Sidney Jones, whom I knew very well, developed that, but they wouldn't put their money in the final stages.
No.
So we lost it. The Italians did. Bingo. And we're paying for it. And we did all the initial development work. Mm. Bloody stupid civil servants.
Yes, well, but don't you realise that trains at that time were going out? No one was going to be using them in 10 years' time.
And what's happened?
This is what you deal with, you know.
Now you've got bloody trains that we can't have because we haven't got the right diesel engines for them anymore because Europe says so.
Don't you remember?
So we've killed our diesel engines because, oh, they've not got the right emission control. We haven't developed any, so we can't have any diesel engines. Oh, dear. And we're now running short of trains. Oh, dear. Which silly bloody civil servant is allowed to impose these sort of stupid rules on us? It's high time Parliament got its act together.
Yes, we're now straying into definite various political areas.
Yeah, but that's the point, isn't it? It comes down to politics at the end.
In defence area, we've got this in 1994. Didn't they say there would be a huge peace dividend?
What?
There's never been a Cold War. There's going to be a peace dividend. No, there wasn't. There was never going to be a peace dividend.
There never is.
No. There's a peace dividend at the end of big world wars because you demobilise a hell of a lot of troops. But there isn't.
Yeah, but we finished the Second World War, we were back into business again with Cold Wars and all the rest of the bloody thing.
We have the joy of Korea.
And Korea and here, there and everywhere. Mm. You know, I mean, politicians just try to tell us, they think we're daft.
Well, I think the problem is, there's too much self-interest rather than actually putting the priorities of, you know, the nation or whatever it is further or near the top.
Is this the trouble with the admirals and the fleet, the marshals and the generals?
I think there is an element of that. I think there is a need for some really serious thinking about, you know, the sort of people that you have sort of developing what you want in the future. And I think one of the big problems we've had in the UK, and I'm the I am not the person to say this, but in the sense of I do think that we have devalued what I call the practical aspects of a lot of our technology. In other words, engineers have not always, on one hand, stepped up to the mark to provide forceful enough
leadership,
exactly. And on the other hand, there's been a sort of slightly they're beneath the salt type of people.
And that
I think is an attitude, whereas in Germany that's not the case.
And Opera. Whereas you've got the case now that we got rid of 500 and we're now 50 short, so we're having to get 30 from the US Coast Guard.
Well, there's that. That's at a sort of tactical level, but at the leadership level, we need some professional engineering people to provide, but they need to provide the leadership as well of what can be done. No, I agree with you. And I think we need to encourage that. That's what I think there is a deep issue there.
The accountancy profession seems to regard engineers as expendable. They can buy them anywhere.
Yeah.
But the trouble is you can't. An engineer is an engineer, not a bloody draftsman.
Exactly.
You've got
to look at German industry to see the role of engineers in their success.
Yeah. Because eventually, I mean, all right, sometimes we make mistakes, but bloody hell, look at the mess that accountants have made at bloody Tesco.
Well, quite.
I do think
that there is a cultural thing in the UK where we have not encouraged and promoted in the broader sense, not just promoted up the tree, but made them more important to how our economy works. I think the engineering technical aspects are important.
Don't you agree? In the end of the day, because we're not manufacturing anymore, our currency is vulnerable.
Yes.
And this is the whole point. But you can't tell a civil servant this. He thinks his little bit of paper in his arm says something different. So you're wrong. Go away. Mr. Engineer, you don't understand what you're talking about. I sat on committees in the Department of Transport, the efficient ship project. Tried to get it through, but the bloke thought it was better for his career prospect to go and do something else, so the whole thing was shut down and sold off to the Japanese.
Yeah.
For 20 grand.
Yeah.
Jeez. Oh, God.
So where do you think we are then, Alex, in terms of grand vision and ruthless pragmatism? I'm just looking at the time.
I think this will be one which will probably carry on into another one at some point. But
well, I think you can't solve it. I don't think there's a solution, because you nor I are in a position to force the issue. Mm. And this is, always seems to me, the problem, that we are not, none of us are in a position who know what, who can see what's going on, are in a position to force pragmatic decisions to be made. The politicians make decisions to suit the colour of their underpants, if you might, by expression. And they get very frightened, very easy.
Mm.
And very few of them are Margaret Thatchers of this world, who say, bugger this, it's going to be this. Get on with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, like her or love her, she did do that, definitely. I think...
Well, yeah.
There has been a problem in that we've got leadership now by focus group and by committee.
Mm.
And the trouble is, these things are all great ways of absolving yourself of responsibility.
Mm.
And you don't need to be pragmatic when you're not responsible.
Mm. No.
You can afford to have a grand vision as long as you're not going to be held responsible for it.
Yeah. I mean, listen to all that, read all those papers we had the other day. Oh, the committee decided this and the committee decided that.
Mm.
Stupid decisions. I mean, I showed you one.
Yes.
Last Thursday.
Yes. Dad and I end up going to National Archives quite regularly, and we both do research there. And some of the papers from the 1920s and 30s, and 1950s as well, which are out there, where they have the committee papers out. Some people think this is a new thing. It isn't.
No.
And it's quite on. What I find quite funny is this one guy called Admiral Henderson, who was a vice admiral. And he was the controller of the Royal Navy in the late 1930s, and Third Sea Lord. And he had a committee which reported to him, and used to regularly tell them they were wrong, and to basically, in a polite term, go away and come back again when he agreed with them. And it was kind of funny, because if you consider all the good ship classes we had in the Second World War, the illustrious class... Unicorn, the light fleet carriers, most of our good cruiser designs, definitely all our good destroyer and submarine designs, they were all pushed through by him against the recommendation of that committee. But as he would often say, the buck stopped with him. He would on a Sunday go and wander around the ships being built and talk with the people in there building the ships. In plain clothes, he'd just turn up on his own and wander around them to have a look at them and see their progress. And when he found a yard hadn't been making the progress they'd been telling him, he'd turn up on Monday morning in full dress, with a full guard, and all his attendants, and would rip the yard manager a very politely done new rear exhaust pipe. This was... But I now look at the current... leadership, and I go, well, we haven't got anyone like that.
We've got no one who knows what end of a ship is.
Right.
I mean, they started promoting blokes who are not seamen to captain warships.
Yeah.
How the bloody hell does a man who's not a seaman captain a warship?
Mm.
I mean, it's just civil service nonsense.
Yeah, quite. Right.
I mean, why put a man in charge of an infantry division who's never commanded infantry?
Yeah.
But well, that's what the civil service do. Oh, it's his turn.
Yeah, quite. Yes, it's
Buggins' turn.
It's political correctness in another form.
Well, they put a brigadier in charge of the aircraft carrier procurement, and then wondered why the guy was BAE had managed to con him into redesigning the propellers.
Yeah. I think this is a good time to sort of wrap up.
But what I'll do is I'll let you both sum up, and I'll add in a little bit of summing up. So I'll let Dan go first.
It's interesting, Paul. It's nice being talking to you.
Yes.
I hope we've managed to air our tonsils a bit on things we find Well, I mean, I've been at it now for 60-odd years in the shipbuilding business, and I get bemused by the sort of things that go on.
Yes.
And I feel, you know, that we really haven't really solved the problems. We're still back in the 1940s, 50s when I started. We're still messing about.
Messing
and it's
about
not messing about in boats, but we should be getting on our act together.
Yes, well, I go along with that. I think that's that. I mean, my short career of 30 years in the Navy was my experience was that one was always amazed at how people seemed to be relearning lessons that should have been learnt some time beforehand.
Well, one wonders what Sandhurst and all these places, Dartmouth and all these places do.
Well, quite. I agree. That's another subject in itself, but I agree with that. No, that's all I've got to say, Alex.
I missed one out, Cranwell.
Yeah, well, right.
And I will add in that whilst I set the question, I have to say the conversation was never going to be dominated by me with this particular group. It's been most interesting, and the thing is, I sometimes wonder if what you really need to come forward is a leader who's got grand vision of ruthless pragmatism. That might actually make it work, but they're very rare.
They are few and far between.
Right, I will say thank you to the listeners for listening to us, and I will add in that if you want to see more papers, please go to Phoenix Think Tank or SimSec. Both are great organisations. There are a few papers up there by me. There's also some papers by me on British Naval History, which I add in. And there is currently also going up a series of Falklands War podcasts from the East Atlantic, which you should also go and listen to because they're very interesting. And I think I think the one that's gone up today, when we're recording this, happens to be two paras talking about their experience in the Falklands War.
Yeah,
and that's really revealing. Right. Yeah. And, well, good night to all, and thank you for taking part.
Good night.
Okay,
cheers.
Good night. Bye.
Do you like the Sea Control podcast? Sure, we all do. However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SimSec website. Sign up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. How do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?